for argument is Hall v. Zenk. Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. This Court should reverse the District Court's grant of habeas relief in this case because it granted it without any support in clearly established federal law. The primary thrust of the respondent's argument in this respect is that there's a circuit split that has resulted from some retreats from a statement of a rebuttable presumption that should be applied in these cases from Remmer in the form of Smith v. Phillips and United States v. Alano. In the wake of this, there are many varied approaches in the district courts and the circuits to addressing these kinds of problems, and the respondent's position is that that prevents this from being clearly established federal law upon which habeas relief can be granted. The character and the content of the split of authority in this procedural argument are fairly well fleshed out in our briefs, or in the respondent's brief, at least, and we would rely on that before this Court for the purposes of that argument.
Has there ever been a hearing about an evidentiary hearing about the about what the jurors may have thought as a result of this report to them of the inmate's vote?
There were not, Your Honor.
There's never been any sort of hearing.
There has been a hearing, but Your Honor's question I perceived as being more specific as to whether these jurors were questioned about the effect that the communication would have had upon them. And Indiana law is pretty strict in that they won't inquire about the mental processes. The answer to Your Honor's question is no, but there was a hearing at which there were six affidavits produced, and one was produced by Mr. Hall, which was an alternate juror, and five were produced by the state. And it's in that respect, Your Honor, that we think this case is a lot different than Weishart, which is why the district court, acknowledging the split in authority, felt that it was compelled to grant relief. In Weishart, what we had was a capital defendant who came forward some 10 years after sentencing with an affidavit from a juror stating that they had learned of a polygraph test that had been taken by Mr. Weishart prior to his trial, or during trial, actually, I believe. And the juror said that we heard about this, and then we resumed trial the next day. We heard the trial had recessed for that purpose, and then we never heard anything else about it. And that was the extent of any knowledge that the court had before it with regard to that extraneous communication. And this court, based on that paucity of information, granted the writ and sent it back so that more evidence could be produced on that question of how pervasive was this communication, and to just learn more about how it happened and how it was disseminated to the jury. And I believe, Your Honor, if I fairly construe Weishart suggested that the state courts inquire of the jurors what the effect of being privy to that communication was. Now here, the principal difference is that the nature of this communication just basically doesn't have the same kind of prejudicial potential that the Weishart case presented.
Except here's what makes me uncomfortable with the Illinois appellate ruling. They wrote, you know, the burden of proof was everything and suggested that the party assigned with the burden wouldn't be able to meet it. But then in the ruling they said the fact that the inmates lived with Hall and once believed he was innocent but changed their belief to guilt renders the impression that the inmates had special insight into his guilt, seemingly gained as a result of their frequent contact with Hall and ability to see Hall when he had not composed himself for a jury. But then they later say, if the jury allowed themselves to consider this information, there can be little doubt that the information had a prejudicial impact on the verdict obtained. And Hall's relief was still denied. That seems a little... That's the language of the Illinois Appellate Court that I'm grappling with that troubles me.
And, Your Honor, I think that what the Court of Appeals did in that instance was the same thing. You've seen evolutions in how these cases have been dealt with in the federal courts over the years. For instance, in the Tenth Circuit in 1982, initially they felt that the presumption from Remmer, by operation of the new 606B evidence rule, became an irrebuttable presumption. And I think that that's how the Indiana Court of Appeals was thinking about this. They knew that Indiana law didn't afford the presumption to the defendant, but they felt that it should, and that if extraneous contact was established, and it is in this case, the extraneous contact is established, that if it dealt with anything that touched on the defendant's innocence or guilt, that it was therefore irrebuttable. The prejudice was irrebuttable. And that's not how the majority of courts that have dealt with these cases process these claims. There are other ways to rebut the prejudice other than asking each juror, did this information in fact bias your verdict?
And what would you suggest have been the right process here?
I think that the trial court, when it had adjudicated the claim in the first instance on the defendant's motion to correct errors,
just getting these affidavits is enough.
Yes, adjudicated it on the affidavits and determined that it just didn't pose a risk of a substantial prejudice. And the Court of Appeals...
So there'd be affidavits from the other jurors? I mean, that's what 606B permits.
And, Your Honor, there weren't affidavits from the other jurors.
Right.
There was one from the alternate. And
there have been?
There's nothing...
It would be devastating. Mm-hmm. If the inmates think he's guilty, they must have insight. They're criminals. They know the score, right?
Well, Your Honor,
they're not biased against other criminals, right? So they say he's guilty. They sounds like something you should listen to.
I don't know that
that's... Imagine a juror might not put it in those terms, but might acknowledge that you know, I had thought about it. Maybe it had an influence.
Your Honor, I think in that instance, it's really no more prejudicial than if the jury had been privy to, say, for instance, a newspaper article about the trial that had a picture of the defendant walking into the courtroom covering his face or something.
No, that's a little different than the inmates being there who he's with every day. Yeah. And he's not in front of a jury or in front of anybody else. And then I still don't see how you can run from that language for whatever reason the Indiana court said it, to say that the jury, if they had allowed themselves to consider the information, little doubt that the information had a prejudicial impact on the verdict obtained. That's pretty strong language from the court.
It is.
That's language hard for you to run and hide. You know, so the point that perhaps there were more affidavits from the other jurors would be very helpful.
And Your Honor, to address that, I would just respond that there's no indication that he couldn't have presented additional affidavits. Mm-hmm. There was no order by the court that they do. You know, he did ask to depose the jurors, and he was not allowed to subpoena jurors for deposition for this because of the policy concerns behind Indiana's rules on that. But it's the respondent's position that the Indiana Court of Appeals characterization of the portent for prejudice from this is overstated based on the affidavits that were presented, the only evidence on this, and that the trial court's conclusion was much more reasonable. I mean, the bottom line is the Indiana Court of Appeals affirmed, and they couldn't have done that had they found prejudice. Rather, what they did was find that he should have been entitled to the presumption and decided that it would have been irrebuttable. And that is just not required by clearly established federal law. And for those reasons, we would ask that this court reverse the district court. And I've reserved 2 minutes of time. If the court has no further questions, I would possibly waive that after Mr. Cleary's presentation.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Martin. Mr. Cleary?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Martin. The district court correctly granted the writ in this case. I would jump back to Judge Posner's question. There was no evidentiary hearing held. There was a hearing held on Mr. Hall's request to do depositions. And I think that's interesting that the state at all times opposed Mr. Hall's request to depose the jurors. Those depositions could have been limited to the simple fact of, did you hear this?
Just could have been limited just to the simple fact of contact, right?
Right.
Without getting into the deliberation.
Right. There was no 606 would have allowed an inquiry into, did you have this? Mr. Hall requested that in the state court, in the trial court. The state opposed that. He took an interlocutory appeal all the way to the United Court of Appeals, and the state continued to oppose that, all the while conceding that extraneous influence had reached the jury. The state court here made unambiguous factual findings, supported by the record, that there was improper communication with Hall's jury. This was a violation of the rule established by Remmer that improper communication with the jury about a matter before the jury is presumptively prejudicial, with a heavy burden on the government to show there was no effect. That rule has been reaffirmed by this court in Oswald and Weishart, both of which were cases that arose on habeas. That is, the court granted relief to habeas petitioners due to a violation of the Remmer rule on improper communication. I think the facts of this case are every bit as egregious as those in Remmer and Oswald and in Weishart. Oswald was on trial for the murder of his 3-year-old stepson. In Indiana, murder is not a bondable offense, so Hall was incarcerated at the Grant County Jail pending trial. There was a family connection between one of the jurors, Juror Daniels, and one of the inmates who was with Hall, who was Juror Daniels' stepson. The stepson initially told the family that they thought Hall was innocent, but then at a decisive moment in the case, right before the jury goes in to deliberate, the stepson relays information that Daniels overhears that they think Daniels is guilty. Daniels conveys that information to the jury right before deliberations. Juror Hopkins says that this occurs at a time when there was no consensus yet about Hall's guilt, and he had put forth a defense that this was an accident, and Hall gets convicted. Shortly after the trial, and I think this differentiates from Weishart, immediately after the trial or immediately after the sentencing, Hall comes forward with this affidavit. It's not a situation that occurs a decade later in which, you know, memories might be impaired. He comes forward within a matter of weeks with a motion to correct errors under Indiana law attaching Juror Hopkins' affidavit. The state responds with Juror Daniels' affidavit and a few others, but essentially, and the state court found this, those affidavits are essentially harmonious on the key point, which is that Juror Daniels told the jury what he had learned through it from his stepson, that these guys think Hall is guilty. In response, the state conceded improper communication at the trial court in the motion to correct errors. As I mentioned earlier, Hall tried to depose the jurors. He fought that battle all the way up on an interlocutory appeal, wherein the state again conceded that improper communication had occurred. He raised the issue on its merits in state court. He lost, where the state placed the burden, contrary to Remmer, upon Hall. And the state court found as a fact, again, that improper communication had occurred. He raised the issue on habeas, and I think the court correctly granted relief. I think given the facts of the case, which is an indisputable improper communication with the jury about a matter before it, and the law of this circuit, which is Oswald and Weishart, the district court made the correct decision. There's been no compelling argument made that appropriate deference shouldn't be given to those state court fact findings, and there's been no compelling argument made why the rule in Remmer, reestablished or reaffirmed in Oswald and Weishart, shouldn't apply with equal force to Hall. I mean, it's difficult to imagine a more prejudicial communication than what occurred here. Hall was, you know, almost essentially on trial for his life. He's facing a murder case. He put forth a defense that he had not intentionally harmed his stepson, that the injuries were a result of an accident. And as the jury retired to decide his fate, they were told that the men who lived with Hall night and day thought he was guilty. The jury learned he was in jail, which is something they're not supposed to know. He's appearing in street clothes. And they would have now known that the people physically closest to him, that he's spent about 8 or 9 months with, now think he's guilty. Hall's rights to a fair and impartial trial were violated. I think habeas relief was appropriately granted in this case, and the court should affirm the district court. If Hall is to be convicted on these charges, it should be by a jury that is untainted by improper communication.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cleary.
Thank you,
Your Honor. Mr. Martin, do you have anything further?
I do agree with you, Your Honor.
as possible. With respect to the affidavits, there's nothing in the record that suggests that Hall couldn't have presented affidavits with this other non-thought process inquiring type of information. And in fact, when he was on appeal, he agreed that that was contrary to state law and that the information that did touch on that, that was in the affidavits that were before the court, shouldn't be considered. And it's interesting that the information about jurors that were present, including the alternate that gave the affidavit on behalf of Hall, all showed that this wasn't impactful to them. Daniels said that it didn't impact his verdict at all. Hopkins, who was Hall's affiant, said that he would have found Hall innocent. And another juror was reported to have not remembered hearing anything about this during deliberations. And lastly, and this is with response to your question, Judge Williams, one of the things about the Indiana Court of Appeals analysis is it refuses to consider the strength of the state's case, which we contend was overwhelming.
Well, thank you very much. And Mr. Clear, were you representing Hall pro se?
I was not, Your Honor. Mr. Hall's family.
Well, we thank both of you very much for your arguments, and the court will be in recess.